This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusa in for Anthony Brooks. More now on today's big story, dramatic proposals for controlling health care costs in Massachusetts, as well as the rest of the week's news, including the Massachusetts race for Senate and the continuing fallout over that $50 million executive pay package at Liberty Mutual. Time now for our week in review. Renee Loth is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you.
John Carroll is a BU communications professor, author of the blog CampaignOutsider.com. Welcome back, John.
Nice to be here.
So, guys, as we heard before the break, this health care payment reform will peg health care costs to the state's economic growth. It'll start penalizing hospitals that charge more than others with a 10% tax. Do you think that the state is being aggressive enough?
Let me start out by asking, am I the only one here who doesn't believe that his health care premiums are going to go down by $2,000 in 5 years? I don't believe that. And one of the reasons I don't believe it is because when you look to cut costs, the last thing you want to do is set up a quasi-governmental agency to start doing it. I mean, this has all the earmarks of a classic boondoggle. And I think it's great. I would love my premiums to go down by $2,000. Don't get me wrong. But I just wonder if this isn't all sort of politicking as usual in a way to make people think that something's going to happen. We have 41% of the state budget goes to health care at this point. And I think that, you know, it's got to be addressed, but I'm not sure this is the way to do it.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit more optimistic than that, maybe. First of all, as I understand it, it's a $2,000 reduction over what would be the increase in growth within 5 years.
I'm sorry to interrupt. That's not what they said. Right? $2,000 cheaper than it is today.
Okay, fine. The point is, it's a very ambitious plan. There's no question about it. They're asking for a reduction in half of healthcare costs, which have been growing at an astonishing rate. They're eating into everything else. We can't spend money on education or transportation or anything else because we are overwhelmed with healthcare costs, and we got to do something. Yes, there's a possibility of another government boondoggle, but, you know, this the proposal is to create a board or an organization very much like the Healthcare Connector, and that's really surprised people. People thought that would be a boondoggle, too. It really has turned out to do a pretty decent job of setting up these exchanges where people can get healthcare, and it's been, you know, kind of a clearinghouse for that. So I'm not entirely sure that the problem here is too much government. I think the problem may have been not enough government oversight on this industry, which kept saying that it could police itself and really never did.
Well, the merits of the bill aside, let's touch briefly on its viability in the state legislature. This is the House plan that comes out today. Next week, we're going to get a plan from the state Senate. Senate President Therese Murray says she wants to get it passed by July 1. Is it going to have an easy time of it, Renee?
No, I don't think it's going to have an easy time at all. Healthcare is a gigantic part of our economy. There are lobbyists with lots of yank up at the State House. This is why it's taken over a year for the House to come up with a version of Governor Patrick's proposal, which was first, you know, delivered like in February of last year. It's incredibly complicated. But I do think there is one thing that's hanging out there to be a bit of an incentive, which is the presidential campaign. This has implications for the presidential race as Governor Patrick continues to campaign for President Obama as an example of, you know, a place where health care has worked and
Massachusetts sort of being the laboratory for
exactly.
National health reform.
And not only on access and coverage, but now on costs. So there is going to be some, behind the scenes pressure to get something done before the campaign.
There's also implications for Mitt Romney because he's been going around saying
that's
that
right.
This has been terrific for the state. He doesn't want it for anybody else, but it's terrific for the state. Now, all of a sudden, into the spotlight comes the incredible runaway costs of Romney Care, and that's going to be something that he's also going to have to answer for. So it's worked well in getting people insured, but from a cost standpoint, it's just one more millstone around his neck, I think.
Might Mitt Romney be in the unenviable for him position of having to agree with Deval Patrick, an Obama surrogate during this campaign season on this issue of cost control?
It might. He also might become the head of the Division of Healthcare Cost and Quality if he doesn't win the presidential race.
What a bipartisan move that would be.
Yeah.
On the part of the second Obama administration. Moving on, let's talk about the Senate race, which took an interesting turn this week. The leading Democratic candidate, Elizabeth Warren, found herself in the middle of a rather strange controversy over her Native American heritage after it was reported that Harvard had promoted her as a minority faculty member in the 1990s and that she herself had identified as a minority in a law directory. Warren's campaign staff, meanwhile, attacked Republican Senator Scott Brown, calling him a hypocrite for putting his 23-year-old daughter on his own insurance plan, courtesy of the Affordable Care Act, which, of course, he opposes. And lastly, there was some real honest-to-goodness news. Another Democratic candidate, Marissa DeFranco, gathered the requisite candidacy signatures, putting her on the path to appear on the primary ballot up against Elizabeth Warren. So let's go through these in order. Elizabeth Warren is, in fact, at least 1/32nd Cherokee, but she says that that's never been a factor in her hiring.
I applied for one job in 1978 by letter, and every job I've had since then has been from someone recruiting me into that job. And they've come to me and said, because of your work, we'd like you to come here.
Earlier this week, one of our listeners commented on our coverage of this and said, not even 1/32nd of me cares about this non-story. John Carroll, is there a real story underneath all of this?
I think there is a real story, unfortunately, for Elizabeth Warren. And not to get technical about it, I don't think there's any paper on this yet. I don't think anybody's come up with any concrete proof, which is why Elizabeth Warren is going around talking about her grandfather's high cheekbones. I mean, you know, that's bringing them out of the woodwork with the references to Martha Coakley. I mean, all of a sudden, the connection between the two is starting to get played up more and more. I think that this is a sort of an inauthentic, inept moment for her. And I think that she's a rookie candidate. I think that a good primary race might have helped her a little bit in clearing some of this stuff out. But now she's doing it in a very high-profile way with Scott Brown. And I think that it doesn't really mean that much, but it does mean something to voters. I think it just reinforces a storyline that Scott Brown has been trying to push, which is she's elitist, she's out of touch, and also she doesn't have sense of what's important to real people.
I believe that she did produce a genealogical document to back up the
okay, I stand corrected then.
But still, she stipulates that it's highly fractional quality.
Right.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much substantive is important or at issue here, but campaigns are crucibles, and rightly so. You know, you get thrown into a really hot, oven, and you try to come out, sharper and better for it. And I'm not sure that they're tests, in other words. And I'm not sure that Elizabeth Warren did such a good job on this particular test. I mean, her responses were a little bit evasive at first. She was unclear. She wasn't, it took some time for her to admit that perhaps she had, so listed herself. That's what matters here, not the question of whether she is or isn't 32nd, Cherokee, or whether she's an affirmative action baby. That's not the issue. The issue is how she's handling this, this controversy, and points to Scott Brown for coming up with something that would put her on the defensive.
The good news for Elizabeth Warren is Harvard Law School does list one Native American in its diversity census. The bad news is that they won't say it's her. So she has this possibility that it's her. But I think it's a distraction in one way. But as Renee says, it's sort of revealing in another way. And I think that Elizabeth Warren needs to get a little more aggressive, a little more her campaign under control and focused a little bit.
Well, this week, immigration lawyer Marissa DeFranco surpassed the 10,000 signature mark that she needed as one step toward qualifying for the September primary. Here is DeFranco saying that she's here to stay.
I've been in this race since March of 2011, and it's more than a year later, and I'm still here, 8 candidates later, and here I am.
We've been calling Elizabeth Warren the presumptive Democratic nominee. Were we rushing to that?
Well, it may be that she'll be a good emergency backup candidate, Marissa DeFranco. I mean, Elizabeth Warren looked like she was going to cruise to the nomination. Now, if I were Marissa DeFranco, I would get really aggressive at this point, going to the media and saying, "This is a race. It should be a race, and I need to get some equal time here." If she can get on the radar screen, I think who knows what might happen.
Well, I think just to follow up what John said earlier, this is actually good news for Elizabeth Warren because she can use a primary. And, DeFranco,
For experience's sake?
For experience, just to see what is thrown at her, sharpen her message, all of it. And she's a very good candidate, DeFranco. The sort of interesting political dynamic, ideological dynamic, is that she's actually to the left of Warren, which is really, you know, for the Republicans, they'd say that's really going somewhere. And in a way, could help, again, Warren look more moderate by contrast, sort of the way, you know, Romney looks so much more moderate as opposed to the super conservatives who are running against him in the primary.
Yeah, but Romney was also pulled to the right by those super conservatives. Does Elizabeth Warren risk being pulled to the left?
I don't think she has to. I mean, it's a question of, again, it's going to be a test for her. You know, how much discipline does she have?
And I'm not sure it's right or left, actually, for Elizabeth Warren. I think her problem may be that she can't connect with blue-collar Democrats. And if that constituency defects from her, and there are already indications that they're moving Scott Brown's way, that's going to be a pretty high, big obstacle for her getting elected.
Yeah, I just want to just remind everybody that the math still does favor Warren. I mean, this is going to be a big Democratic year. It's a presidential campaign. There'll be almost a million more voters than there were in Scott Brown's special election, and many of them are going to be Democrats. Brown will have to win a big hunk of them in order to be able to beat Warren. It's possible, but the math is still favoring her.
Let's touch briefly on someone who the math is really, really favoring. This is the continuing news about Liberty Mutual. For the past couple of weeks, there's been a lot of outrage about this $50 million a year pay package that former CEO Ted Kelly received. Brian McGrory of the Boston Globe has been hitting the story like a drum, pointed out that that's $24,000 an hour and amounts to what he calls an utterly grotesque level of executive pay. And what sets this story apart from other executive pay stories is that this is a mutual company, not a publicly traded for profit. So Ted Kelly has said this week that there were some accounting issues, that much of the money that we're reporting about was deferred performance incentives in the form of what's called phantom stock. But accounting issues or not, he still walked away with $200 million over the course of 4 years. So, Renee, do you agree that this is excessive, or do you think that this kind of pay is defensible? It does seem that the company has been doing very well.
Well, it is a mutual company, and the members of this of the company, who are the shareholders of the stakeholders, are only seeing their premiums go up. So I don't know. The math is really good for Kelly. I don't know about the customers of Liberty Mutual. You know, also another element that makes it relevant to the public is that the company got a $46 million exclusive tax break, just, you know, aimed at Liberty Mutual.
Well, this is for their new building downtown.
Right.
And it's been funny to me that as this has been going on, the Boston skyline has been dominated by this crane that's down there on that construction site.
Wait, exactly. And, you know, I think that makes it a story of public interest. And, you know, these are just not good times to be, you know, taking in not just the high salary and the executive, stock options and all the phantom options and all that kind of thing, but also the, you know, the private jets, the, you know, going to vacation locations, and the cozy self-dealing by the board members. I mean, it all just is very bad timing for that kind of story.
John, this is our theme question for today. Real story or a bunch of hot air?
Oh, this is a real story. The crane was also used by Kelly to pick up his paycheck. So, you know, that...
Ba-dum!
Little known fact. I think that this is going to go into the textbooks as, a case study in how not to handle a news scrutiny. I mean, they have done the worst kind of job. Accounting issues, you know, I mean, they have accountability issues, but the accounting issues is a loser. Phantom stock options, you know that's going to go over like the metric system. So, I mean, this whole thing has been so mishandled, but one of the really interesting things is it's only the Globe that's covering this. Look around. There's nobody else covering this. The Boston Herald hasn't touched it. This is the Globe story. And by the way, Todd Wallach, who's a reporter over there, has also done yeoman's work in terms of bringing this up. But this has not really taken off. It's really interesting that this is something that you would think would really catch fire. And so far, at least as far as I can tell, it hasn't. So I just wonder if there's something particular about this story that has kept other news organizations from jumping on it. I don't know why they haven't. They're always reluctant to go after somebody else's scoop. I mean, you always have that kind of thing with news organizations.
Oh, we're never reluctant about that here at WBUR.
Well, you guys, yeah, and that's why we're talking about
exactly.
This story now, but nobody else seems to be. It's a really odd situation, but I think they've mishandled this from the get-go.
All right, let's conclude with our weekly hubbub, the story that didn't make it into the body of our conversation. Meghna.
Since we're talking about accounting issues, and apparently math seems to be a theme in this week's Week in Review, I'm going to steal a story right off the front page of the Globe, and that's today's Globe, and the fact that the Red Sox organization insists that it's had this huge long streak of sellouts at Fenway Park, where in truth they're giving away tickets, there are empty seats. So, you know, I would think that the idea of a sellout means that there's that many fans out there who are willing to hand over their cold hard cash to sit and watch a Red Sox game, where in truth, you know, they're calling it like, you know, we distribute tickets, and so therefore Fenway's full.
Phantom tickets.
Right. Phantom fans, too, apparently. So that's my hubbub, and wondering what the new math is down on Yawkey Way.
I believe that's what they on the wire called juking the stats. Renee, what's your hubbub?
Oh, well, just in the category of cool things, starting tomorrow, Saturday, the Boston Society of Architects and some other nonprofit organizations are launching new 90-minute architectural boat tours of Boston, starting at the Four Point Channel Atlantic Wharf area near the Tea Party Museum and going through South Boston, the Boston Harbor, through the locks in Charlestown, which I think is very cool.
That's fantastic.
And then up through the Charles River. They're narrated boat tours and, you know, they're educational, but of course also they'll be fun. It is to be hoped. And starting in June, I believe they'll be daily, but for the month of May, they're just on weekends.
Man, sign me up. That's fantastic. John?
It saddens me greatly to note that the New York Broadway production of Magic/Bird will be closing next week after 1 month on the boards. In a shocking turn, they didn't receive any Tony nominations at all, and this has caused them to shut the play down. So luckily, it will probably appear in many regional theaters in some really toe-curling productions on the local level, so we can look forward to that.
Indeed. I also have some sad news, and this is actual sad news. Adam Yauch, better known as MCA of the Beastie Boys, has died. He was always the gravelly-sounding one, but you can hear on that last record just how hoarse he was from the salivary cancer treatments that he was enduring. And if you feel it chilly, I'ma get you a shawl. He was just 47. I encourage everyone to check out the hour that he did with Tom Ashbrook on Point in 2008. They talk about hip-hop. They talk about his filmmaking career, his activism for Tibet. The whole interview was actually captured on video, and it's on YouTube. I really, really encourage everybody to check that out. Adam Yauch of the Beastie Boys, dead at 47. That's it for our Week in Review. John Carroll, thank you so much.
Thanks, Adam.
Renee Law, thank you as well.
Thank you.
Well, still to come, Antoine Dodson, double rainbow guy, and media thinkers get together in Cambridge. Plus, we'll hear the music of Otmar Liebert. Stay with us. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.